business. Well, actually, that first part of the tape doesn't seem to record. But I can start here. This is Sunday, January 7th, 1973, in Saigon. Today, Bill Henderson and I were taken out into the country for lunch by Captain Thin, a press officer of some sort, and Mr. Bick, who used to be involved in the government and now is helping to organize the Mekong University. The most important thing they said to us, I think, and this was really the captain, and I assume he was reflecting the government view. He said that the government of South Vietnam, which opposed a settlement in October, November, on the terms that Kissinger worked out, does not oppose a settlement today. He said that he thinks that a ceasefire would be of advantage to South Vietnam. One sidelight on his view was his obvious satisfaction over the proof that the South Vietnamese government could hold up the United States government and object to the terms of the settlement of October, November, and prevent it from going through. This was a matter of obviously deep and meaningful satisfaction. When one thinks about it, a very natural thing for a small country, for nationalists, to feel a thing which we don't bother to think about normally. But along another line of discussion, the matter of what we called the leopard spots, the areas of Viet Cong control under a ceasefire of the type that seems to be in the making. The captain and Bick both agreed that even with the large number of international supervisors, the job of patrolling the boundaries of the innumerable areas, spotty areas, of Viet Cong control, that is of North Vietnamese control, really, the sheer job of it looks hopeless. They declared that they expected the areas would be enlarged and merged by the North Vietnamese and merge, and then there would be fewer spots on the leopard skin. It does seem strange that at the same time that they expect that under a ceasefire the North Vietnamese control of areas of South Vietnam would not only be hopeless as a matter of supervision, but also be enlarged. Should be found side by side with the view that a ceasefire is to their advantage. They were very strong on the point that while the Tet Offensive of 68 was a great victory for the other side in the world press. It was a victory for South Vietnam here on the site, they said. They emphasized the point that the people did not rise, the people rallied to the government, the people proved that they support the government, as opposed to the Viet Cong and the North Vietnam and communism. They cited also the fact that every able-bodied man in South Vietnam has been given a gun, and we've observed these men in civilian clothes with guns, especially at curfew time, and here and there around the city. And they argued that a government that is afraid of its people wouldn't give the whole people arms. They seemed to think, on the whole, that a ceasefire would give them time to grow strong, and that if they had this time, they would be able to maintain their independence against the North and all the other problems are unimportant compared with that. This seems to be the basis for their central view that now, unlike last fall, a ceasefire is in the interest of South Vietnam, meaning South Vietnamese nationalism and independence of North Vietnam. On the side, I might mention that when we drove out, we passed quite a few miles of terrible shacks, which they said were occupied by refugees, but also by some people who worked in the new industrial plants that are being built north of Saigon. These shacks. But one could observe in South Korea a few years ago, outside Seoul, or in Calcutta, on the outskirts of Calcutta in India, or, as a matter of fact, the Hoovervilles of 1929 to 33 in the United States were pretty much of the same sort. Later in the afternoon, Bill and I took a and wandered about the city. We found a cemetery, which by luck was the one we were looking for. Jim is buried there, and his brother knew. There are heavy stone slabs over their graves, and many pots. There are no names on the stones, no names to mark these graves at all. When I asked the Vietnamese who had helped us find the graves why there was no name, no names for either Jim or Nu, he was obviously somewhat embarrassed and said something about reasons. That was political reasons. This is Tuesday, January 8th. This morning, Bill and I were taken by Miss Singh to sit in the visitors' gallery of the lower house of the parliament of South Vietnam. It was impressive that in the classical style, there were opposition members sitting on the left side of the aisle, and they spoke up. They argued against, for example, the program of President Thieu to require a coalition of all the smallest parties into a maximum of five under a rule that a party must command 20% of the seats in Parliament in order to be recognized. There was a little contretemps when a member of the opposition thought he wasn't being recognized by the chairman or speaker, who is, after all, an appointee of President Thieu. But he was recognized then, and he spoke. There were no American correspondents in the newspapermen's gallery. The whole experience led me to think about and to talk with Bill about the particular situation of a country which not only has an enemy of great strength backed by great powers to the north, but also has a lot of its territory occupied by this enemy. For such a government to tolerate opposition really seems remarkable, and if we were to find ourselves in anything like the same situation, I wonder whether we would restrict ourselves to the limitations placed on free press and so on that President Lincoln carried out. The immediate execution of the Nazis who landed on American soil in the Second World War, the relocation of Japanese, I wonder whether our record would be no worse than that. I wonder whether our record would be as good as that of the government of President Thieu. Ms. Singh explained to us that the Prime Minister and leading members of the government are not members of the Parliament as in the British system. They are appointees of the President. But they appear in Parliament during sessions and sit at certain tables forward on what is really the stage of the old French opera house, where the house meets. And they also accept questions from members on the floor in the style of British members of the government. Bill and I went for lunch to a French restaurant behind the caravel, where a sort of club table is maintained for foreign correspondents. They seemed extremely young, and according to Bill, they make no effort to establish contacts and sources inside the government of the Republic of Vietnam. Instead, they develop their dispatches out of their observations and gossip among themselves. I think it has become true that good news of any kind about South Vietnam is not considered to be news. It's really the obverse of the situation in the Second World War, when bad news about anything that our military were doing abroad was not news. Without anyone planning it or conspiring, it seems that the press develops a certain point of view and provides news that supports that point of view. No one really is guilty in this situation. It's just a matter of what is considered to be news. If the war in general is popular, the news is of one kind. If it's unpopular, like this one, the news is of a different kind. And any information that contradicts the general view is simply ignored as not being news. Certainly in the United States, we don't read about opposition members in Parliament speaking up, and in one case this morning, shouting to have his way and getting his way. This afternoon, Bill and I went to what a lot of writers have called the 5 o'clock follies, the news briefing first by the Vietnamese and then by the American. The main news, besides handouts about bombing north and south of the DMZ, bombing which seemed to be directed solely at trucks, the main item handed out or given to us verbally concerned a terrible accident that seems to have happened at Da Nang, where American planes loaded with bombs and dropped them by accident on the base at Da Nang, some wounded and some damage. I was really shocked that the United States Army provides such a crummy room for these briefing sessions. Hot, very poor light, crowded, very poor loud speaking system, and it looks almost as if the scheme were deliberate as a plan to make the correspondents uncomfortable. Then Bill and I met Mrs. Zung, our Foreign Office representative. She turns out to be no girl, but the mother of four. She took us to meet Senator Tai, who represents a small Buddhist constituency and is chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. In spite of being a member of a small minority party, and he is also the Vice President of the Vietnam Council on Foreign Relations. This latter organization is really Bill's host here. It's modeled on the United States Council on Foreign Relations. Senator Tai sat us down on lounge chairs with tea, and we conversed on a wide range of topics. He seemed to be quite pleased to talk about ancient times, meaning events of 1954 and onward, and even the Roosevelt period, which he remembers quite well. And so I raised some questions on those earlier times, and he was quite intelligent about it all. He was very firm on the point that the Geneva Accords did look to and take into account the actuality of two governments in Vietnam. I'm not sure about this so far as the wording of the accords go. I think the wording leaves the matter open, although in fact, of course, there was the Bao Dai government in the south as well as the Viet Minh government in the north. Bill and I had a little discussion of this, and we aren't really agreed on it, so we're going to have to check the actual document carefully. Some writers make a point against Dulles and Eisenhower that no government was to be set up south of the demilitarized zone. On the two sides, there were to be only withdrawal zones. And these writers blame Dulles for hurriedly encouraging the development of the Diem government. Senator Tai made no controversial points worth remarking, but through him I hope to meet more people and to get into matters a little more deeply. I must correct the date of these notes. Today is Monday, January 8, 1973, not Tuesday, as I said at the outset, mistakenly. I've walked around the streets of Saigon enough now to make some comments, perhaps. These stories we read endlessly about the stolen American goods and stuff from the PX stores for sale on the sidewalks are vastly exaggerated. I have observed just as closely as I can, and there are innumerable sidewalk displays of things for sale. I've seen just about nothing that could possibly come from America or from a PX. There are endless Christmas cards, endless little gadgets and doodads, but nothing of the kind that is generally featured in feature stories by journalists. The streets are dirty, but not as dirty as most of those in New York. There are a number of whores around. They seem to lurk inside storefronts and avoid coming out onto the street, probably observing some technicality of police regulation. On the famous terrace of the Continental Palace Hotel, where everyone is supposed to sit and watch the world go by, Bill and I observed a young American man lording it over a crowd of Vietnamese girls, with one particular, very aggressive, very unpleasant girl as perhaps straw boss of the crew. And we thought, of course, that he's a large-scale pimp. Yesterday we saw, as we approached the terrace, a jeep with several Vietnamese policemen carrying this American pimp, if that's what he is, away, along with that one girl. And we thought that would be the end of that story, so far as we could observe. But no, today he's back at the same old stand. So whatever the police did, it wasn't very serious. Either the police are very gentle and forgiving, or they simply get their cut, periodically perhaps. The ugliest thing about street life is provided by the immense hordes of Hondas spewing gasoline smoke and roaring along, and the small cars doing the same. They're really hard on the nose
and the ears. As for the eyes, there is one great compensation. The girls in their Ao Dai, the astonishing colors of these costumes are a sight that no city in the world can offer. In the world can possibly match. One doesn't see anyone else on the street because nothing compares with these girls. If that's a sexist remark, I'm getting the full benefit of it. This is Tuesday noon, January 9th. This morning, Bill and I were taken by Mrs. Zong to the deputy minister, or more accurately, the assistant minister, of the Chuhoi program. This program is designed to invite VC and North Vietnamese Army members to defect to the South Vietnamese side to rally to this government. And it promises them a very short stay in a Chuhoi camp and then assimilation into the society at large. So we talked at some length with Assistant Minister Hung. He was a very keen, very well-spoken person who understood English fairly well, but used an interpreter most of the time. The interpreter has studied in the United States. And after some discussion about the program in general, in which we learned that 200,000 plus VC and NBA have come into the Chuhoi program, we got aboard the car again and went out to a Chuhoi camp. It was a most extraordinary sight. On the whole, it looked like a rather simple, sunstruck barracks with court in the center and low buildings with rooms full of bunks around the perimeter. And in the center, one larger building with classrooms and so on. We went into a particular room and sat down and had a long talk with a captain of the North Vietnamese Army who has defected and come into the Chuhoi program. He was a most impressive person. Spoke differently from the South Vietnamese. Obviously had a stronger, harder accent. And he seemed a very strong and extremely vital sort of person. He had been in command of a battalion that invaded the South, retired into Cambodia, and then attacked in South Vietnam again. And we probed just as much as we could for at least an hour to get at his thinking and his reasons for coming over. They seemed very, very convincing. He spoke of a lack of rice, a lack of ammunition. He spoke of the lies which he and his soldiers had been told. Lies about how the South Vietnamese people wanted to be liberated from the American imperialists. But whenever they got near the South Vietnamese, they ran.
And he decided that he was tired of lies, tired of hunger, and he also made some statements that seemed full of pathos about how he has been in the Viet Minh and North Vietnamese army for 20 years, and he has no family. He was married at one point, but he was married for only 3 days. And he came to the Chuhoy program in order to build a new life. We tried also to get him to talk about the point of view of a North Vietnamese soldier on the questions debated in the United States about bloodbaths, for example, at Hue, or in any town where the VC or North Vietnamese Army takes over, the executions and so on, which one hears about, of the notables, the leaders of a village or city. But we got no particular...